They say New England was built on bedrock and blood, its foundations layered with history, hauntings, and horrors that never made it into the textbooks. But what if those whispered stories told around campfires were true? Tonight, we're venturing deep into the haunted hollows, murky lakes, and monster-lurking woods of America's oldest and strangest region. From sea serpents to flying moose, from cursed black dogs to UFO crashes that never made the news, New England hides secrets right in plain sight. And our guide tonight, Jeff Belanger, renowned author, Emmy-nominated storyteller, legend hunter, joins us to reveal the wicked, strange truths behind the myths that cling to every stone wall and forest path in the Northeast. So strap in, darklings, because in New England, the past isn't just history. It's alive. Coming out September 2nd is a brand new book called Wicked Strange, your guide to ghosts, monsters, oddities, and urban legends from New England, with photography by Frank Grace. Jeff Belanger here with us. Good evening, Jeff. Good to see you again, buddy.
Good to see you, Dave. Always good to see you.
So you've got a lot going on, obviously. I mean, Emmy nominated, best-selling author, lecturer, and of course, we got to celebrate. This is a pretty big fact. I mean, you have been the lead writer and researcher for the Ghost Adventures series since episode one.
17 years.
That's crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
And that's opened you up to, even in your area, finding all new legends and lore, things that where you grew up, you weren't even familiar with, right?
So I think a lot of us fall into the trap of thinking all the cool places are far away from where we live.
Right.
And you got to remember that where you live is far away from most of the world. So my first book was called The World's Most Haunted Places. I'm like, well, I can't look here. They got to be far away. And so I looked all around the world and found all these great, haunts and stories. And but then I wrote a book called Weird Massachusetts back in 2008. And that really changed me, because it was part of the Weird US series. And they said, hey, you live in Massachusetts, you should do that. And I realized how embarrassed I was at all the stuff around me that I hadn't seen before. And so I spent over a year just sort of doing what I do, but doing it where I live. And I went, oh my God, there's so much great stuff here. And as you know, the more you look, the more you find. You find one story, they're like, oh, you're looking about that ghost in the graveyard. I thought you were talking about the headless horse that still haunts the old, the old barn. And you went, wait, what? The headless horse? I never heard about that one. And so you just go down all these rabbit holes. So since then, I've really sort of thoroughly enjoyed relearning my own roots in history through all the weirdness that's around me. It's around all of us. I just live here.
For those of you familiar and subscribe to the Paranormal 60 network, we've got great shows every week on that podcast network. And every Monday we have, of course, Jeff and Ray with New England Legends, and they bring you in not even just the paranormal and weird stuff, but they bring you into some of the fun, kitschy, niche kind of little discoveries around New England as well. Are you surprised this deep into, and how many episodes do you have now?
409, but who's counting?
Apparently you. Are you ever surprised that you're 409 in, and yet people still keep emailing you with, well, did you know about this?
So when I first started, I said, oh, we got to do the big stuff that people know, the really meaty stories. And we did, and we do those still once in a while. But to me, the most interesting are the obscure ones. So what the audience grew over time, people listen to the podcast, and I grew up where I grew up, but people grew up in little small towns all around the place. And they said, well, in my town, we had this story. And no one would really know that unless you grew up in that town. So a community sort of formed around the podcast, which started actually as the television show on PBS and then Amazon Prime. And then the podcast is just easier to cover more stories more quickly. And so, as the community started to share stories, now we're hitting our stride now. I mean, every day almost I get an email saying, hey, have you heard about this? And sometimes you're like, oh, that's interesting. I just don't know quite what I could do with it. But sometimes you go, this is just gold. I can't believe I missed it. And then you put it on the list and you get the next one. So really, and as you know, Dave, doing this as long as you have as well, at some point you become a magnet for these stories. people, you know, have a weird experience. They look up, well, who else, who looks into this stuff? They find you, they find me, and they reach out and they tell you about it. And sometimes you just get some great story leads to explore and investigate.
Well, obviously New England being one of the oldest settled areas and this true melting pot of all these cultures that came together and moved to the new world. Do you believe that these beings and creatures and myths and legends were already here? Or do you believe that in some ways these people brought these beings, these energies with them from the old countries? I don't know if I'm being clear on the question.
I got you. I think it's a little bit of both. For example, one of my favorite weird cryptids around Massachusetts is the Pukwudgie. And the Pukwudgie comes from Wampanoag folklore, right? So Wampanoags inhabited mainly like eastern Massachusetts, Cape Cod, you know, go a little bit north, a little bit south, and a little bit west. But that was mainly their region, and they mingled with other people. And the Pukwudgie is, if you've never heard of it, is like a little miniature magical creature that looks almost human, but could turn himself into a ball of light. They can be helpful. They might lead you as a ball of light down a path and get you back to your village. Or they might lead you off a cliff and kill you. It depends on their mood. There's no way to know. And I thought, oh, wow, what an interesting sort of creature. Described as like a little miniature human with magical abilities. But then you look into like Irish legends and lore and you go, huh, that same sort of description, Will-o'-the-Wisp, you know, comes up. And then you look into other European countries and you find it. You look into Inuit culture out in Alaska and they've got the legends of the little people. Very similar. Africa has the same thing. This same creature is popping up all over the world in their folklore and legends with different names, but very similar descriptions. And you go, either all these cultures that we're told had no contact with each other whatsoever made up the same story, which is still mind-blowing, or maybe there's really something to it. So when Irish immigrants came to New England and said, oh, a little magical creature, I know what that is. It's a will-o'-the-wisp. That's our word for this thing. And the Wampanoag said that's Pukwudgie, and other people use their label. So we see something we can't explain, and we so desperately want to try to define it that we put a word on it, and it gives us a sense of control. It's a false sense of control. You know, like just by labeling something doesn't mean that you're in charge, but it just makes you feel a little better. Like, oh, that's a Pukwudgie. Got it. In reality, we don't know. So I think some of this stuff is just sort of around us all over the planet, and we do our best to label it or understand it. And other stuff sort of we carry with us. But no matter what, it survives because we talk about it and we share it.
You know, I always talk about the concept of the 100 monkey rule, that once the 100th monkey figures something out, like, oh, if I take this stick and put it in the ant hill, the ants will climb on the stick. I can lift it out. And now I've got an ant sickle, right? Right. And then all of a sudden, once the 100th monkey has this experience, almost like a global consciousness wave, they start noticing that monkeys and primates around the world develop this ability. So I've often wondered, if you start telling folklore and legend and myth enough, does it take hold of this global ethernet and download to people so they think that it's a reality? They think it's a truth because it has been spoken about so much that it's almost, you know, in that concept of the tulpa, it has been breathed to life. And we'll continue on with that conversation and more. We've got Jeff for the remainder of today's hour. What about that concept? We'll discuss it next, right here on the Paranormal 360.
Oh, are you reading me? Come in. Hello?
Greetings from the shadow, and welcome to Shadowzine. My name is Jeff Belanger. I'm an author, podcaster, and explorer of the unexplained. For 30 years, I've been investigating the paranormal, UFOs, monsters, and things that bump in the night. Lately, you may have noticed how major TV networks and even social media networks have been pushing our favorite subject back into the shadows. I say good. That's why I launched Shadowzine, a monthly underground publication that covers your favorite topics in depth by some of the leading writers and researchers out there. If you're looking for 30-second TikTok clips, go somewhere else. If you're ready for a deeper dive, put down your phone and pick up Shadowzine. You can't find it in stores. This is old school print. Head to shadowzine.com and be part of the underground revolution. That's shadowzine.com. And I'll see you in the shadow.
On the Paranormal 360, we like to take a well-rounded approach and look at all things strange and supernatural. And our guest, Jeff Belanger, is certainly part of that world, strange and supernatural. We were talking in the last segment about how there are all of these different myths that seem to pop up around the world. They're very similar, but everybody has a different name for it because it's kind of to their area. Slenderman comes to mind, Jeff, right? Sure. We know that Slenderman, the character, was created as an online contest for a writing contest to create a creepy creature. We can follow its history, right? The creepypasta, and see the origin of this. And yet people began believing Slenderman was real. And it took such a foothold. There were video games, movies, video programs that took off. But people started believing. And there was some tragedies. There were some people that were attacking one another in the name of Slenderman, trying to gain favor with this mythical creature. And I thought it was so strange that people would be that easily influenced. And I guess that's a big surprise. I shouldn't be that surprised by how easily influenced we are. Yeah. However, when I started digging a little deeper, Jeff, I realized that there is this kind of archetype of Slenderman that's always existed.
Sure.
We thought it was invented in the late 1990s, early 2000s for this creepypasta. But what it turned out to be is that it has always been there, lurking in many different cultures, this long, tall, shadowy-like figure, sometimes with spider or octopus tendrils that will come out of its back. And is this thing always there, but once in a while it gets reawakened, refreshened, and then it takes on a new life of its own? What do you make of all of these different concepts kind of being breathed into life and seeming to take on a reality?
There's a movie with Jeff Bridges. I forget the title, but he plays a country singer named Bad Bart or something. And he talked about a song where he starts to play it. And he said he was strumming a few chords and someone said, "Oh, I think I've heard that one." He said, "That's the thing about a really great song. It sounds familiar the first time you heard it." And it's right? It's true. Right. Sometimes you hear a story or a legend where you go, "Oh." I mean, I think about like some of the various Goatman stories, Goatman Bridge in Texas. There's a Goatman in Louisville, Kentucky. They show up all over the place. And you say, well, that's ridiculous. Half man, half goat. And then the backstory is like a circus train crashed and this monster's lurking in the woods hunting people. However, if you go back to like Roman mythology and Greek mythology, there's a half man, half goat. It's been around. It's been around for thousands of years. So all of a sudden, it's like hearing a melody that's in your DNA, even if you're not aware of it, it's still buried in there. Some of these stories pop up. They have a new name, but something about them is just familiar enough that you go, ooh, I believe it enough that I want to know more, or I want to look into it, or I want to study it. And some people believe it enough that they go into a very deep dive and they make it their reality, like a tulpa, like you said, or a thought form, to the point where with Slenderman, I remember it was, wasn't that Minnesota where there was some teenage girls?
Wisconsin,
right. Yeah. Wisconsin. Some teenage girls at a sleepover literally tried to stab a girl as an offering to Slenderman. And the girl thankfully lived, but only by a miracle. And so you could say there's no such thing as Slenderman, but tell that to the victim who was stabbed on Slenderman's behalf. Doesn't get more real than that. And that's sort of frightening that we do have the power to create reality. And we do it all the time. I mean, I think for anyone who thinks that the idea of a tulpa is so abstract, if you have any paper money in your wallet, reach in and pull some out, right? But why is the $20 bill worth more than the one? I've been asking this question for years. It's the same size, same color, same paper. The only reason is you believe in it, and I believe in it, and we collectively agree that 20 is worth 20 times the one, and you can get pizza and beer with that, and the $1 bill will maybe get you a pack of gum. And that's a collective agreement we have. And if you stop believing in it, it stops working. And that's happened. Right. Think about the Confederacy when after the Civil War, the Confederate money became useless almost overnight. So on the first day, a loaf of bread might cost you 10 Confederate dollars. And by Wednesday, it might be 20. And by Friday, I don't care how much you have. I can't do anything with it. I don't believe in it anymore. No one's backing it up. It's now just paper. It's not worth the paper it's printed on. And so we do this all the time. We believe things into reality. But some of these stories, I think there is sort of this collective consciousness that we all have, that we all tap into. Some of it, some of us ignore it more than others. Some of us are really ingrained with it. And that's why these things pop up. I was reading a book about creativity by Rick Rubin, the music producer. It's a great book if anyone is looking for a good read. And he talked about how sometimes people get upset, like, oh, that sounds like a melody I wrote, you know, a few weeks ago or a month ago, but his idea, his point was sometimes ideas have a time that just comes. And if you don't seize it, someone else is going to, because right. that thing is literally bubbling up and it's ready. Slender Man might literally be an example of that. Slender Man was ready to resurface under a new name and a little bit of a new story. However, something about him was always familiar, and we latched on to the point where here we are still talking about an internet post on a message board.
Did we latch on, though, or do you believe? I mean, we know that there are things that we cannot see that exist, whether we want them to or not, right? You and I know these things. We've had experiences.
Yep.
So do beings exist? And when they see something come to life in the global consciousness and imagination, the things glom onto it. They're like, oh, okay, you don't want to believe in, you know, this old fantasy story anymore, but Slender Man, I'll become Slender Man. I take on that visage. I start to become, you know, this I being the eternal or ethereal creature takes on the thing that people are paying attention to.
There's something to it. I do think it's a two-way street, right? Communication is literally defined as two or more parties, right? Mm-hmm. One person yelling in the woods alone isn't communicating. You're just shouting, but two or more, that's communication. And that takes some cooperation. And so we're ready, it's ready. And somehow it's coming together at the right time, at the right place to sort of manifest into something. And that's why we've talked about, we've never found a haunted place that's haunted 24/7, that you can go there right now and the ghost will just be waiting to wave to you. Sometimes it's like a lightning strike. You're at the right place at the right time under the right conditions, and this thing manifests and you've got a story to tell forever.
Beliefs can be dangerous. We're going to talk a little bit about that in the second hour when Joe Franke from the Warren Society comes to talk to us about the current tragedy that took place regarding Dan Rivera, a paranormal investigator and curator of the Annabelle doll, who was on tour with the Traveling Warren Society, and how his untimely and unfortunate death suddenly spurred a new fear and this global weirdness of Annabelle killed him. You know, our beliefs can actually cause more harm than good. Look at the witch trials and the problems that took place. We'll discuss more of that next, right here on the Paranormal 360.
A vampire in Rhode Island?
A UFO crash in Connecticut?
A flying moose in Maine?
A haunted bridge that calls your name?
New England is weird.
Really weird.
Wicked Strange by Jeff Belanger and Frank Grace is your ticket to the bizarre. Ghosts, monsters, urban legends, and roadside oddities you won't believe until you see them.
So pre-order now on Amazon. It drops September 2nd.
Assuming the Black Dog of West Peak doesn't get you first.
Let's get strange.
Wicked Strange. Pre-order your copy now on Amazon.
Wicked Strange, the brand new book out by Jeff Belanger, will be out and available September 2nd. We have a link in today's program guide so you can pre-order your copy now. And let's do that. Let's pre-order the living heck out of this book so that it hits as a number one bestseller. And then remember, I'm going to say it. I always say it. I preach it. I live it. Don't just buy and read the book. Rate and review the book once you get it, because every rating, every review goes a long way to help get more exposure for the authors that put their heart and time and soul into each one of these books. We talked a little bit about belief going out of the last segment and the fact that how dangerous belief can be, how quickly fear can spread, right? There's that great Twilight Zone episode, right? The monsters on Maple Street or something, where it's just a seed planted that among this community, something lurks. And everybody starts looking at each other as being the one guilty and finding that glimmer, that reason why that person must be the monster. And it's an interesting way to look at how we perceive the world around us and how quickly we are willing to jump to the supernatural, jump to the creepy, jump to the darkest parts of human society in order to justify our fears or to give our fears a name.
When we're afraid, the primal part of our brain takes over. It's, if you're scared, you're not reasoning real well. That's all humans, all people, right? You can't really think well if you're in a frightened state. So there's so much information coming at us all the time. We hear news stories, we hear strange things that we get scared and we jump to conclusions that maybe we shouldn't necessarily jump to. Now, as you said, you and I have seen some weird stuff that we can't explain. I would even go so far as to say, sometimes when we've seen it, I know I wasn't particularly frightened. We were in places, but we're in these places all the time. And so you see something weird, you go, hey, look at that. Are you seeing that? Yeah, I'm seeing it too. The shadow moving back and forth between jail cells, you know, and you go, huh, I didn't feel threatened. I didn't feel frightened. I wasn't ready for fight or flight, but I was looking at that kind of objectively. I think you too, you were right next to me and thinking, well, isn't that weird? You know, that's that we're in this place where people have seen ghosts and maybe we're seeing one. So in that case, I don't think we were jumping to some paranormal conclusion because we were under no threat. We had permission to be there. We were, you know, all on the up and up. But at other times, you're right. When you start to knock over dominoes and you go from, oh no, it's a curse. Oh no, this, oh no, that, then yeah, it can go to a rough place. I was interviewed on a news show. Oh God, this is probably over 10 years ago now. Every August 28th, I remember the date because it's my sister's birthday. There's a alleged ghost train that rolls through, I want to say it was like Tennessee or something, by this bridge. And the ghost train comes through at midnight on August 28th. And 10 or so years ago, someone went out there at midnight to see the ghost train and started walking on the tracks on the bridge. And a real train came and this man was killed. Hmm. And I was asked to sort of comment on that. That the story was, I mean, imagine, we talked just a minute ago about how we've never seen a place that's haunted 24/7 where you can go there and the ghost is always ready to wave. But imagine if I said midnight, August 28th, go to this trestle train track and you'll see the ghost train. That's a date and a time and a place. And so this guy went and was hit by a real train and died. And I was asked what I thought of that. And this pretty much relates to your second guest and what's you're going to be talking about tonight. And I said, look, obviously, I'm all for checking out legends, but you don't have to go on the tracks. You could have stayed 20 feet off the tracks and just looked, right? You would have had the same result. Well, you wouldn't have died. But I said, I'm certain that over time, this death is going to become part of the legend. It's going to get woven in. Give it enough time and someone's going to say, I heard the ghost train killed him. It's just, that's what happens. You lose the details. They get fuzzy, but you do remember there was a train. There was a derailment. People died. There's the story of the ghost train. And then another guy died all these years later. So it's still sort of happening. This is a cursed place. This is a place of disaster. And that's something that you give that energy. And all of a sudden, you know, that you've got a problem. Police officers will tell you, when you're driving down the highway and you see someone pulled over, it happens where someone fixates on the car saying, oh, don't hit it. Don't hit it. They're changing a tire. Don't hit it. And they hit it. You see it coming for, you know, half a mile and still you do it. You fixate on a thing and you tell yourself, don't do this one thing that you end up doing. We're a strange creature, us people. And so, our beliefs are our stories. They affect our behavior. They affect the way we interpret everything around us.
Let's talk in this last segment. We've got about 3 minutes here and then another allotment of time together. But let's start talking about some of the weirder New England legends, maybe even some of the ones that surprised you the most. We hear about ghosts and vampires, werewolves and witches. And what actually ended up having some meat to it? What are a couple of your favorite stories that jump out at you like that?
So I just worked on one the other day that did you know tomatoes, all tomatoes are poisonous, Dave. They'll kill you. Do you know
what?
I know. That's what people believed right up until the 1800s, especially in New England. Everyone understood tomatoes are poisonous. You do not eat them or else. And this guy named Michel Korn came over. He was originally from Italy, grew up eating tomatoes his whole life, loving them. and came to New England, where they were grown, but they were decorative. Everyone said, oh, yeah, the very bright red fruit, very pretty, but you can't eat it. You'll get sick. And he would eat them every single day and say, no, you got to try these things. They're delicious. And everyone said, no. Everyone understood. You'll get sick and you'll die if you eat these things. It turns out both stories are true. They're delicious and they can kill you. Because when the tomato made its way from Italy into like Europe, European aristocracy would dine on the tomato on their pewter plates. And the acid from the tomato would leach the lead out of the pewter. And so they would eat the tomato off their pewter plates and they would get sick from the lead. But they just assumed it was the tomato. Can't possibly be the plate. And so it just got around. If you eat those things, you're going to get sick and some people even die. So no one would touch it for years and years and years until this guy introduced the tomato to first Newport, Rhode Island, and then eventually New England, and then eventually all of America. So the next time you're eating a salad, Dave, the next time you're munching on some pizza.
Eating a what? A salad?
A salad. It's what food eats.
Yeah.
The next time you're having some pizza, think about this guy from Newport, Rhode Island, who said, you got to try these things. I'm telling you, they're delicious. And that's the thing, a story. Someone heard a story. They're not good for you. And they avoided it. And we don't even think twice about it now. And that's just the humble little tomato.
That's crazy. What a cool story. What a weird story. But don't worry. There's ghosts and vampires and monsters coming up in our last segment here together. Again, don't hesitate. Go pre-order. Get the book right now. Wicked Strange, Your Guide to Ghosts, Monsters, Oddities, and Urban Legends from New England, with photography by Frank Grace, written by Jeff Belanger, who is also the host of New England Legends podcast, along with his partner Ray, and he is well-received in the Emmy world for his programs, Our New England Legends, and those are available to check out. They're still on Amazon, correct?
Yep, Amazon Prime. You can watch right now.
All right, check out Our New England Legends on Amazon Prime. We'll be back with more right after this. Hey, folks, you want to be part of Minnesota Legend and Lore? Then join me this October, because I'm going to be joined by Dalen Spratt from the Ghost Brothers TV series. We're going to be out at the Palmer House in Sauk Center, Minnesota. It is a weekend filled with paranormal hijinks and fun. As a matter of fact, we're going to have a costume party on the first night, and then the next two nights are full-on investigations of the Palmer House Hotel for all of its hauntings and history. We'll also be hearing presentations, a gallery session with Diet Renee, and more. You can get all the information at darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. Our guest is Jeff Belanger. Jeff, in the last 7-8 minutes we have together, let's talk about some of the more creepy, weird stories of New England that, again, seem to hold water even all these years later.
One of the saddest haunts, I think, around is a place called Connecticut Point Lighthouse, which is right off the coast of Warwick, Rhode Island, which is where the airport is. And the story, so first of all, there's so many lighthouses up and down the New England coast. Almost all of them seem to have some kind of ghost story related to it. But Connecticut Lighthouse is just about a half mile off the shore. And there used to be an amusement park called Rocky Point that was right there on the other side. And this is one of those lighthouses that's just the house and like a couple of rocks. There is no land. It's just you get out there on a boat and you stay there. Back in 1922, Ellsworth Smith was there with his wife and their two young sons. And imagine having two young boys in basically a house. And that's it. There's no yard. There's nowhere for them to go. They're just cooped up there all the time. And in 1922, his wife was really struggling, saying, hey, can we just rent a place on the mainland and you come out and visit on weekends or whatever? And lighthouse keepers don't make a lot of money. And he said, no, we just can't. This is it. We got room and board, and this is what we can do. Well, one Saturday in June, Ellsworth takes the rowboat to the land to get some supplies for his family, and he's going to be gone all day. And as soon as he leaves, his wife gives some poison to both of their sons and takes some herself. And when he comes back, he finds his youngest son dead, lying on the kitchen table, finds his older son sick in the corner, and finds his wife dead, lying in their bed. He scooped up his older son, who was still alive, got him back to shore, got him to the hospital, and thankfully he lived, but the other two never made it. And he never went back. He couldn't possibly face that job. And the thing about a lighthouse is it's one of those really boring jobs, but ultra critical, right? And at night and in storms, you've got to keep the light on. Lives are depending on you. And so other keepers moved in literally the next day into this place where this horrible thing just took place. And it had a haunted reputation almost from that day going forward. When the Coast Guard eventually took over, they would sometimes sleep there at night in the quarters. And one of the Coast Guard officers woke up and said to the lady of the house, like, hey, why did you come open my bedroom door and check on me in the middle of the night? And she said, I didn't. And that would have been Mrs. Smith. Today, it's fully automated. It's just this rusting lighthouse. But when you know the story that the job and the life was too much for one family to take, and then you hear the stories of people encountering their spirits all for decades after that, it's just a chilling place, especially when the light is just right.
Hey, I love a good werewolf or vampire story. Is there what?
We have plenty.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to say. Is there any actual meat to any of these stories? Not just, oh, you know, keep the kids in at night, but let's tell them monster stories so they're not out mucking about in the dark. Do you feel that there's any stories that actually live up to the hype?
So there are a couple that I do. So New England has many vampire stories. And unlike Nosferatu or Count Von Count, when here vampires were consumption victims or tuberculosis. And that was called the wasting disease. You would just waste away to nothing. It would eat you from the inside. It was a bacteria that got in your lungs and you'd cough and bleed. And it was awful. And even though people understood contagion in the 1700s and 1800s, they still, sometimes when a pandemic's going on, people lose their minds. And imagine if one by one, everyone in your family is dying from this sickness. And someone says to you, hey, there's an old remedy, but you may not like it. You may be the victim of a vampire. If you find the original source, if you find the vampire and destroy it, you might save your family. And that's exactly what happened in Exeter, Rhode Island. Mercy Brown, she was, I think, the fourth in her family to die from consumption. And when Mr. Brown's son, Edwin, got ill and someone told him, stop the vampire, he went to the cemetery. Mercy had died in the winter, so she was in a keep, which is a above ground crypt where they stay until the ground thaws and they can dig in the spring. Right. And when they went in, they said her body had moved. It had sat up and it was in a sitting position. And a medical doctor removed her body, saw that she'd hardly decomposed at all. They cut her chest open, found liquid blood in her heart. And that was smoking gun proof to them that she was truly the vampire. They took her heart out, burned it on a rock, mixed the ashes in an elixir and fed them to her brother, Edwin, in an effort to break the spell of the vampire. He was desperate. He was so desperate, he did that to his daughter's body. And yet, Edwin still ultimately died a few weeks later. But any parent knows, I mean, when you're that desperate, you'll try just about anything. Belief is powerful, but I think there's something to it. You have this contagion that's moving around that doesn't affect some families. It does affect others, and it's wiping out whole communities. And when you get scared, you got to put a name to it. And in this case, it was the vampire. But we also have another monster in Rhode Island. We have the Roguerou, which is basically a French-Canadian version of the werewolf. And that came with building a church and a pact with the devil. But I guess that's a story from another time because we're just about out of time.
Crazy. Good stuff. Amazing stories. And again, we've only scratched the tip of the iceberg. Get yourself a copy of Wicked Strange, your guide to ghosts, monsters, oddities, and urban legends from New England. Jeff Belanger, the author. And again, comes out officially September 2nd. You can pre-order it now. And I'm asking you as a favor, all of my darklings, go pre-order the book now so that when it hits on September 2nd, it's an immediate bestseller. You'll love it. Jeff always does remarkable work when he goes in and does the research on things like this. Anything else coming up we should know about, Jeff?
No, thank you for the Shadow Dean plug. That's still going. I heard a rumor that you may know someone who's writing an upcoming issue. I just heard that. I don't know if it's true or not.
Well, time will tell, my friend. Time will tell. I'm looking forward to it. I will have an issue coming out very soon, so I'll let everybody know about that.
Sounds good.
From shadow beasts and haunted hills to cryptids that defy explanation, Jeff Belanger reminds us that legends aren't always just stories. Sometimes they're warnings etched in folklore. But as we close the book on the myths of New England, we step into something far more immediate and far more dangerous. Coming up in hour two, we shift from the forest to the artifact case. A tragic and unexpected death, a cursed doll on tour, and fear is mounting as the legacy of the Warren artifacts returns to the spotlight. Was it coincidence or a curse? Joining me is Joe Franke, founder of the Warren Society and former associate of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Tonight, he sets the record straight about the truth behind Annabelle and gives us an in-depth view of the dangers of working with cursed and haunted objects. The secrets, the lies, and the truth next on the Paranormal 360.